Gary, good evening.
Good evening. Welcome. I'll turn my camera on very briefly so you can all see where I am in the middle, in my car, parked, charging up. The bandwidth is pretty poor here, so I shall turn the video off and talk to you.
From a charging point somewhere in the UK.
Yes, indeed.
And it's good to be back.
Always make good use of your time and changing.
Yeah, it's good to be back. We did the live show last week. It was good to see you in the comments and the commenters on there as well on the YouTube channel.
I was enjoying that. Listen to your tones.
That was quite. It's good for that. So I did a bit of a Q&A one for anybody that see the live stream. So it's up on the YouTube channel. So a bit of QA. People sent questions in. So we did a bit of sound design Q&A and went through some stuff. So quite good fun. I prefer to have a set topic, but I thought for a change we'll do a Q&A. So I think we'll do another one of them in August. So, but it was good to have a friendly face in the comments. But it's actually the comments and the chatters are all really nice as well. Really, so it's quite nice to have a friendly bunch in there. So I did enjoy doing that. Coming up this week then, so we've got lots to talk about. We've got some new builds of Windows, which we can talk about as well. I've got some newish new old equipment, something you might be familiar with. I wanted to talk about EV. We could talk about Goodwood and a movie about one of the first EV devices that certainly was the ones that I was aware of that was quite interesting that I watched. And a few more things as well. So I think we'll start with the new bit of kit that I've got. And I think, Gary, you might be familiar with this one. This is the Roland D110, and I've got to thank Steve, a listener and a fellow ModWave user, because he actually dropped it off at my house for me. I didn't. He said, I've made quite a few sound banks that he's used, and he said, could you make use of my old D110? I said, well, I'm sure I could. So he actually dropped it off, so it was very kind of him, complete with manual as well. Original manual. So the D110 is a rack mount synth from 1988, a Roland one. I think, Gary, you said you've got one, haven't you? Somewhere.
It has appeared on the show before now. Yes. Very briefly.
Yes. So I've got the D110 here, which, like I said, it was a 1988 synth module. Clever thing about the D110, and I've made a little demo song, which I'll play out with on the video as well. I'm showing the video on the screen, but I'll play the video out. I'll play the song later in the podcast, but you can see what it looks like there. So this is a rack mount module that was designed multi-timbral. The idea behind that was from your Atari ST or your Amiga, you could control and play multiple things at once. So it wasn't just like a synth playing a piano sound or a brass sound. You could have on one channel, you could have a brass sound. On another channel, you could have a piano. On another channel, you could have something else. You could have some drums in there. So you could actually make a whole song. This was in the days before digital audio workstations where you could just multi-track to your heart's content. So it was quite an impressive module. I had the D20, which is the keyboard version with a disk drive, which I sold probably about 91, 92, something like that. So when I plugged this in, it instantly took me back to having that synth. My plan is to sample it. I've already started doing some samples of it, and then I'll recreate those sounds on some other synths. But I did do a little demo song. So I made an 80s track from it, which I put up on YouTube. So you can check that out. And it's not like a synth wave. What, you know, if someone makes an 80s track now, they make them all sound very synth wavy, and but it wasn't all like that in the 80s. This is a bit a bit later 80s, perhaps a bit more digital with these sounds. So I've made a little sound. Somebody said it was like a montage scene from a John Con Van Damme movie, so I'll take that as a compliment. it's really nice little modules. It does take me back though to how awful programming on a two-line LED display is. It's only two lines of what, 20 characters, or maybe it's 12 characters per line. And then you've got this amazingly complex syntax engine that's, you know, now I'm doing mod wave programming using a PC editor at the same time as the real hands-on controls. And it's, you know, it's a doddle. But this is trying to understand Roland's concepts of patches, timbres, tones. It's And the manual is not exactly the best written manual either, but I do remember some of it. Some of it has come back to me, but it's interesting way that works, just as a side note, the D series, because as you will remember, back in the 80s, memory was expensive. Sample memory, particularly expensive. So if you wanted to create a nice flute sound, if you wanted to do it digitally, that was too much. Too much memory was needed to make a flute sound. So what Roland came up with the concept is this linear arithmetic system where they only sampled the attack transients, because that's what gives a very distinctive sound of, say, a flute, is that initial breathy bit, or a trumpet, the initial blow, or a guitar, the initial hit. And then you can synthesize the square wave type sound of a flute or a sine wavy type sound, and combine that together. You can make a pretty realistic sound, but using only a small amount of memory. So that was the idea behind them. But you can create some really nice sounds on there. And for the time, they were seemed quite realistic. Of course, as that memory became cheaper, you got synths like the M1, which could use full samples, and you know, then that technology came obsolete. But it actually does give you that some interesting ideas of sound design. So I'm very grateful, Steve, for sending me this and I'm playing with it. I have got another module one up there as well, a later 90s one that he also gave me. He said, could you use this? Yes, I could. One other interesting thing with this Roland D10 is, D10 is they repackaged it and became the Roland MT32, which came a bit of a sort of standard within PC, isn't it, for audio?
It did.
A lot of games, I'm thinking, was it the LucasArts games? They all made use of the MT32, and
indeed.
Yeah, that became a kind of standard for PCs, really, for quite some time.
Yeah.
And I always remember the Star Wars games, haven't it?
Yeah. So I always remember that. So I've spoken on the show before about the piece of music I composed, which ended up being used on a German TV program. And I did that on a D110. Using the ST to actually send it across. And when I upgraded from the ST to PCs, I suddenly found that I could still play all that stuff on the chips set in it.
Yes. <It's good. laughs> Yeah. And the general MIDI as well, that general MIDI standard, a lot of it came from the Roland. So some of the sounds on the D series are actually in general MIDI. I think Fantasy, Soundtrack, Atmosphere, I think there's a few, and the drums being on channel 10 in MIDI, and the kick drum being on a C, and the snare drum being on the D, and that all came from Roland as well. So we're still using some of those technology on there, but anyway, it's a nice fun little synth, and I've had some fun with that, especially doing the little 80 style demo tracks. But it wasn't particularly a stretch. I just did what I would normally record. Normally do. I never moved on sonically, so that's fine. I'll play out with a little demo song later. So other things that I wanted to mention, music tech wise, I did release a new sound pack and tutorial last week. So what somebody asked me, said it'd be good, it was one of the comments on YouTube, said, well, it'd be good if you documented the procedures that you do when you're recreating sounds, because there's quite a lot of these now. So what I did is I've got my old Gen SX-1000, the 1978 mono synth, which is behind me down there. I put it on the desk in front of me there and recreated some of those Gen sounds on the mod wave, and then I didn't pre-do them, so I just did them on the fly and, you know, like sound for sound, you know, just using ear. So I did a video explaining that, and there's some free sounds as well. So it gives you an idea of how to recreate those sounds and how the my methods for doing that. I mean, it depends on what you're doing. If you've got the synth in front of you, it's the easiest way, because you can look at it and hear it and play it. So I did a little video of that as well. So those are available. Those sounds that I did in the video are available as a download as well. So quite good fun with that. Okay, so I'm changing tracks then. We did have some insider builds, and I actually got to do a build video last week because we had a Canary build that had some changes in it. I don't know if you saw these, but so we've got, yeah, so the Canary has got a new lock screen, which is, although they made it out like it was a new feature in the lock screen that's got weather and on top some optimizations, but it looked very much like the one that was running on my release machine. Maybe it just went out to that first, and then a few days later it shipped to the other channels as well, but that it looked pretty familiar. The other thing you can do now is you can pin apps to the start menu, from the start menu. You can now pin apps from the start menu, yeah, to the taskbar. So if you find an app in your all app list, you can drag it to the taskbar and it'll pin it for you. So rather than right clicking or pinning it and whatever you need to do, you can just like find your app, search your app, find it, drag it to the taskbar and it pins itself.
I'm sure you couldn't you do that on Windows 7?
I think you probably could, yeah. There were some other bits and pieces changed as well. There was a setting thing about power optimization. It gives you a recommendation to turn HDR off if you want to optimize your power. The rest of them were fairly minor fixes. But that was last week's build. We also got a release preview build, a beta build, and a dev channel build. No major changes in those, but yeah, we've got the release preview. We've got some new tab things and a couple of bits and pieces as well. So a few bits and pieces to talk about on there, but nothing too exciting. And actually relating to that as well, I am going to do is do a listener survey. We haven't done these for a long time. And I thought I wanted to try and find out which technology things that we're talking about, builds and everything else, EV, music tech, what do you want to hear about, and a little bit on how you sort of consume your podcast. Is it YouTube or Spotify or whatever, just to give us an idea really of where to focus on the show, where to get more guests on, that kind of thing. So I'll include a link in the show notes on the video, but I would really appreciate it if any people, listeners and viewers could fill this in, because like I said, it'll just help us direct where we go and whether we should introduce some new areas, or we haven't taught VR or anything like that for some time now, because that's kind of our interest has sort of waned, well, my interest have waned in it for some time. But if people wanted to hear about it, then I can get someone on to do it. And in the EV stuff, you know, we've had some good guests on there. So do we need to get some more on or what? It's your time to, as a listener or a viewer, to get those on. So it'd be great if you could do that. And yeah, using the Microsoft forms, which I use all the time with Power Automate in my day job, but it's nice to use these. And this was just through my own personal 365 account as well. So it's quite a good, technology, I think, Microsoft forms for doing surveys, things like that. You used to have to use third-party services, but this is pretty straightforward now. So I would appreciate anybody doing that. And if there's anything you think I've missed anything on there as well, you can get in touch at thislifestyle.com or leave comments or whatever if we should be doing something different on there. But it would be nice to get a bit of feedback on the show as we come to into our 950 something show. 951 we are at the moment.
Wow.
Yeah, so we've seen a lot of technology come and go in that time.
Yep.
Especially the EV stuff, which it wasn't even sort of on the radar when we first started talking about it. But actually, I did send you a link because I came across something. I have to make sure I get the right service. I think it was on Amazon. A thing about the documentary about the Sinclair C5, which is probably the first EV that we came across. I don't know if you got a chance to have a look at that.
I haven't seen it all, I have to be honest, but what I've seen has been quite entertaining.
So actually I've made sure I've got the right link. So this video, if you're in the UK, it's on Amazon Prime. not sure about other markets. But it's a documentary here about the, as you can see on the screen, Sir Clive Sinclair, the C5 story. And it's got some interviews with some of the, you know, the creators that were there back in the day, the people that worked on the designs of it, people that worked on the marketing, even, you know, even the people that worked on the outer skin design and things like that. So it's interesting. I was watching it, I immediately thought of you guys because I thought this is the first EV electric EV thing that we sort of came across in the UK.
Well, certainly in the latter part of the century, because EVs were quite prevalent in the early part of the last century. But yeah, certainly it was sort of one of the first things which was seen as a, other than perhaps bumper cars and milk floats, because obviously milk floats were around for a very long time as electric vehicles, but it was a very, it was ahead of its time, which was its main problem, I think.
Yes. It's a fascinating documentary if you like us and you could old enough, you remember it, you know, at the time. And especially as for me, I was a Spectrum user, I had a ZX81 at the Spectrum, so it was always great to see, you know, wonder what's Clive gonna come out with next. And then the sort of the QL kind of, which kind of flopped a bit, which is still, actually I've still got my QL, but the C5 was the next thing, and you can see best intentions and everything else that it almost could have been a hit. In fact, there's an interesting bit in there, I won't spoil it if anyone watched it, but where there was talk about using it as mobility devices for sort of people in Florida, you know, like elderly retirees in Florida, getting, instead of using golf carts to get around, they could use some kind of personal vehicle like the C5 and maybe take the C5 and a different, you know, things done on slightly different and another timeline. The C5 could have been, you know, everywhere in Florida with these personal mobility vehicles, and it could have been a huge success and it could have completely changed the industry. So it's interesting to see, you know, the what ifs on that. But it certainly was a, it was a device sort of ahead of its time, and also I think trying to capture that essence of like early computing, where the Spectrum was successful, the ZX81 was successful because they were pioneering that market, weren't they? Whereas vehicle design and everything else, it was, you know, was been was a whole nother level. You know, there was already established car manufacturers and everything else, and I think as soon as people saw those clips of someone driving a C5 with a big truck, you know, overtaking them, it put people off, didn't it? But in another world, I think in a different, you know, things being slightly different, I think it could have been quite successful. And I still wonder whether those smaller personal mobility devices actually have a place in the future, or whether we're just never going to get to that because we all like big SUV type vehicles.
Well, we do have small personal mobility devices, and they're very prevalent in London, called bicycles.
Good point.
And a lot of them have gone electric these days, e-bikes. And I think the biggest thing holding back personal mobility, personal pets or personal electronic transport, is the battery. I think the absurd risk factor, which seems to have been associated with lithium ion batteries because of the fact that we've had some dodgy manufacturers and dodgy batteries, and it has caused some fires, which you can't argue against, has meant that nobody's prepared to take a risk with them, which means things like you can't take them on public transport in London, which is really restrictive. So even if they were licensed, it becomes a problem to actually carry it. And that actually applies to e-bikes as well. So I think there's some challenges, but certainly they are. I mean, they have some real advantages. I mean, so if you look at the idea of cargo bikes or trikes as a method for deliveries in a city area, they're so much better than having a truck or a van, and get around a lot quicker. So yeah, I think personal mobility has a place. It's just what it will look like, I'm not quite sure. I mean, we obviously know that the idea of e-scooters hasn't gone down particularly well in a lot of places, primarily because of the way they implement them, is the dump them anywhere once you finish with policy of that rental. I think actually the fact they probably would have been far more adopted if they had actually been personal devices, because then they wouldn't have been incentive to dump them on the streets. You'd probably taken care of them a lot more. I don't really know why the idea of the sort of the Uber style of or the rental style of e-bikes and of e-scooters really took off. Because I mean, some of the things they sort of said as the antis for not having personal ones, and the pros for having the licensed ones, you could have gotten around that with regulations. I mean, it's like they're saying, oh, they're better safety quality and everything like that. But you just do the same things you do with bikes and cars and make sure they're safe before they're on the road, when you take them off the road if they're not. And we could have had license plates on them. We could have had registration. We could have had them insured. There's a lot of things which could be done and probably should still be done. And some countries are starting to do that. There are certain countries where you can own an e-scooter and you can license it and actually have it insured. And tends to be more responsibility taken with them than the other things. It's an interesting concept. But we are in love with our four wheels in this country. So I think that it's a very difficult thing to move people away from that. And part of that is probably our weather. If you've got a nice sunny climate for like Florida, yeah, that would make much more sense for a C5. Perhaps that's where you should have launched it in the first place.
Well, yeah, I think that's the thing. I think it could have gone there, and it would make sense there. I mean, on a nice warm day in Florida, taking one of those around a residential area seems fairly okay. Whereas driving around London in the snow or rain doesn't seem quite as appealing. So, yeah, I think that is a big factor in it. It's definitely, if you've got Amazon Prime, then definitely check that out, because it's definitely worth looking at. Small independent filmmaker.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of it. To be honest, I've only got to see about the first half of it so far, but it's been really good.
I mean, it always reminds me of that the favorite thing we have is, you know, the Micro Men film about that era of computing, and it's mentioned a few times in there, isn't it? the electric bike and things like that is rather disparagingly in that, you know, as they're trying to get it to work. So it's mentioned in there as a distraction, really, for Sinclair. But I don't know whether it was that, it was just the next thing for him. But yeah, definitely worth checking that out. On more up to date things, one of my favourite events of the year is the Goodwood Festival of Speed, which it's not all about petrol heads anymore now. It's about technology as much as anything else with the EV side of it. So was there any EV news coming out of Goodwood?
Well, they had the Electric Avenue, which had quite a few vehicles. Now, the electric vehicle news this week, which is I think a little bit disappointing, is Ford launching the new Capri.
Oh, I was going to ask you about this, yes.
Which could have been a great way to hint back. Okay, the Capri styling probably doesn't translate very well into an EV, but this is not a Capri. I mean, it's probably a really good EV, but it's definitely not a Capri. It looks a bit more like incredibly similar to the Polestar 2, which has been out for a while now, but with a little bit bulbous size. There's I think the only hint of it being like the original style of the Capri, if people remember the Ford Capri, is a little angled window at the back. That seems to be about the only thing that really makes it but it's definitely not a Capri. Equally, all through history, car manufacturers have recycled names. Cars they you've made with those names have never been the same, because generationally there's actually not that many people who will be buying this car who will remember the original Capri.
I was going to say, yeah, there is. I mean, we remember the Capri. I was too young to actually own a Capri, really, because they kind of I mean, I could have got second one, but they kind of got past they stopped manufacturing them about the time I was you know, being able to buy my own cars. Had they made one that looked like a an 80s or even the 70s Capri, then I'm not sure it would have appealed to modern drivers anyway, like you said. So the SUV form factor is the thing that, or that, it's not, I guess it's not an SUV, is it? But it's that bigger, taller form factor of car, like you said, like the Polestar, is the thing that sells. But yeah, I mean, the original Capri had an interesting story. It was supposed to have one look, and then it got modified and sort of toned down over time. So by marketing versus engineering and everything else. So yeah, that there is that history to it. But yeah, it probably did the trick of getting, getting people talking about it, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what they did it for. And they've got publicity. And as you say, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Well, there can be, you know, but I'm sure there are things with bad publicity, as in Sinclair's with being lorries bearing down on them. But in most cases, in those things, bad publicity. And this has certainly been, this has got the known game known. If they called it anything else, would it have had so much of a traction? I don't know. I mean, the other thing about this car is it's interesting because it's actually not a Ford. It's a VW under the skin. It's got all, it's all the same innards as the VW ID series. And that's the same with the Ford Explorer as well. They're basically using VW's platform with obviously a few Ford touches on top of it, but it's basically VW's platform. And we're going to see more and more of this, I think, in the EV world. It's really easy to share things. Yeah, that's a Capri.
Yeah, so that what I'm sharing is a nice yellow Capri from 1970.
Yeah, I mean, the yellow colour one. It was a very traditional Capri colour, so I that's one thing they did carry, of course, mustard yellow.
But the later Capris were actually hatchbacks, weren't they? So they did modify them to make them more practical over time. So this is maybe seen as the evolution of that. But yeah, interesting. There was a lot of I watched some of the Goodwood coverage, and there were as a lot. I tell you what, I did like Ford's Supervan. I don't know if you've seen that. I think it was the second fastest car on the vehicle of the day. It's incredibly fast, and it looks like a van, but with a huge spoiler. But it's an EV, and incredibly fast. And I think they said on the commentary that it had the Goodwood Hill climb is a bit like all tracks now, you know, split into sectors. And I think it had the fastest first sector of any vehicle, even though it's a big, great big van thing, but that's just that initial brute acceleration, that the torque that you get out of an EV. This thing was flying up there, but it sounds very sci-fi when you hear it, because you can hear the transmission whirring away with the sort of that high pitch whir, and it sounds like a vehicle from future. It certainly drives right well. It flew up that hill. I couldn't believe it. I think it was from like 47 seconds or something like that. It was just a fraction off the fastest time of the day.
And I think that for hill climbs, EVs are the perfect vehicle. They're always built for hill climbs because of the torque and it continues. They don't drop off, and they've got the traction all the way up there. They're just amazing, really, for that one. What was interesting, I think, moving away from EVs a bit, is that I think every vehicle which ran in Goodwood was running some form of e-fuel. And I'm not a great fan of e-fuels, but they even the steam-powered ones were running with artificial coal.
Yeah.
Which is what's interesting.
Yeah, not the it's something that Sebastian Vettel's been a big supporter of, and he owns, I think it's Mansell's championship-winning 92 car, and I think he's got owns a Senna car as well, which he's driven a few times recently, and they're all, you know, powered by this, what was it called, e-fuel, or what's the correct term of it?
I think e-fuel is what the generic term is for. I mean, certainly reduced emission fuels. I mean, it's not all of them are zero emission, but some of them are reduced emissions. They are better for the environment than running petrol and diesel. I mean, obviously not perfect, but I certainly see a place for them for historic vehicles. It makes a lot of sense if we can keep these vehicles running without damaging the planet. Why not?
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting thing. But it was definitely interesting to know that, you know, in the speed runs up the hills, there was not a huge, you know, it was EVs and, you know, old cars and new cars, but the fastest ones were the EVs. But like I said, it's perfect for hill climb. I think it was one of the Lotus EVs was the first one of its kind to be shown, and I think it pretty much crashed on the first corner.
Oh, yeah, that was hilarious. Too much talk, too much power.
Yeah.
Just couldn't control it.
Yeah, that just shows you the power of these things. But it is, it's really interesting to see those. It's a good venue to see them, actually, at Goodwood. So you're not just seeing them in isolation, just EV. You're seeing it in the, you know, whole thing of motorsport and motoring in general. And they're as exciting to watch up the hill. They don't have the sound. They have their own unique sound, like I said earlier. But they are exciting to watch flying up that hill. So, yeah, that was quite good. I mean, it's something that the Formula E has never really grabbed me, but that I do quite like them. So it's a good environment for them on a hill climb.
Yeah, definitely was really interesting.
Yeah, interesting actually. On the you mentioned the fuels and everything on Formula One. I think they announced the 26 engine regs, and they're removing the MGH and just going with the kinetic recovery and a petrol engine using this e-fuels as well. So the idea to simplify the heat recovery is quite efficient, but it simplified the design of the engines, because I think it's about that as well, isn't it? It's not just the different recovery methods. It's also about simplifying these things, making them easier to race and then manufacture and everything else.
Yeah.
It's like smart home news-ish. My kitchen's nearly finished. I ordered my 10-meter Philips Hue to go around the kickboards at the bottom, which came, and then I realized that the dishwasher is in the middle of that and there's no kickboard on the dishwasher. I could elevate the lights to go under the quartz worktop, which is one idea, or I could split it. I did you because they are you can solder you could you can actually cut them, can't you? And then I could solder some cable, like an old Ethernet cable, go around the dishwasher and have a. But then you're gonna have a gap, so I'm not sure I want to do that. Going around corners on the kickboards was fairly easy. Going around corners on the quartz is not quite good, so I don't know whether to go for a single strip. So I think I'm gonna return the big long cue, and I may just get one of a smaller one to do it. I'm not sure yet, so I'm gonna wait till the quartz is installed, and then I'll make a decision. It's got lights in the kitchen and the spots and everything else, so it's not like I need them. It was just being nice to have. But my great plan was, I don't think this is going to quite work, because you know I've watched videos and seen designs, but of course never thought about that. that dishwasher doesn't work like that. So yeah, back to the drawing board.
I got a really cool free gift actually the other week. Something else I bought, and they sent an RGBIC LED strip with it. Well, actually, one of these neon type strips where it's actually enclosed in the oven, and that's really cool. I mean, it's Bluetooth pattern controlled, so it's a bit difficult to integrate into the smart home side of things. But the patterns you can do that are amazing. Something which they sort of gave away free in the box because they were selling something else to me. I'll try to show it on the next week's show if I get a chance. It's really the patterns are really impressive. I think those types of strips work way better when they're enclosed in that neon type approach, where they sort of put a clear rubber around the actual strip, so it sort of glows a bit wider, and it smooths off the. But you don't see the dots then. You just see the smooth lines of it going between it. It's really quite impressive.
Yeah, I know what you mean now. I'm kind of doubting myself with these now, how I fit these. So the quartz should be on next week, I think, so maybe I'll think about it then, or I might just go with leave the spots in and just leave it that and return it, and I'll think of something else to get. But it's the ovens are smart already, smart ovens and everything else, and it's your smart dishwasher, so I've got all that to play with, so there's plenty of technology in there for me. So maybe I don't know, they'll be ready next week, but in a couple of weeks I'll be able to talk about my experience with the Neff smart homes and see how well they really work.
Excellent. I'll be interested in hearing that, because we'll probably be replacing our kitchen at some time soon. So that'll be good to know, all know about.
Yeah. So I think that was everything I had for this week's show. So I do want to request that anybody, if you get a chance, to fill that survey. And there's not a huge amount of questions, so just check that out if you can. We have got a guest, Pete Brown from Microsoft, coming on in at the end of the month to talk Windows and media creation, PCs and everything else like that. So if you've got anything that we want to be asking Pete about, let me know. And yeah, we're going to sort out our next selection of guests over the next few weeks to get some interesting guests coming on the show. I did have one. Well, we tried to do the recording and we just couldn't get the Teams thing working right. So we're going to reschedule that. But it's quite an interesting one. Sound designer that will be coming on the show as well. Excellent. So what have you got over on your EV channel?
Well, about to hopefully going to have another EV owner show fairly shortly. I'm also got to sum up this car, because this car goes back on, the lease finishes fairly shortly, so I shall sort of try and sum up what 20,000 miles in this car has been like, which has been very, very good. I think the Kia range for EVs, other than the 12 volt battery problems, which is about the only issue I've had, the design of them, this platform they have is really, really good, especially the 800 volt architecture for charging. So I think that's been exceptional. So I'll do some opening up on that, and then it'll be a case of thinking about what I'll be going for next. So which may be a little while off. I'm sort of thinking about whether I wait till a couple of other newer vehicles are coming out, because there's some interesting stuff coming along in the next few months or so. The EV world is changing at the moment, and there's definitely some very positive developments coming in the next year or so.
Yeah, so it's just about choosing the right time to jump back on then, isn't it?
And we're two EV house, so it wouldn't be too much of a problem for a little while to just be run down to one car for a while. But yeah, that's quite interesting. Oh, actually, one thing I didn't talk about this, and it's quite an interesting bit. I've actually had my charger at home charger changed from a tethered charger to an untethered charger. Which is interesting, because the charger is quite old, and it supported both tethered and untethered. So it wasn't actually a difficult changeover from one to the other. But it's a fairly dumb charger, and it didn't work with any of the new sort of intelligent tariffs you can get for charging cars, because there's some really good tariffs out there if you are able to have sort of the electricity company control your charging. You can get things like the 6 hours a night at a cheap rate, and then if you happen to charge during the day, and that you set it to charge on the day, and they happen to think the electricity supply is particularly underused that time, you can still charge at that cheap rate if they let you, and it switches it on automatically and does the charging for you. But you can't actually have one that have that unless you've got a smart charger. Well, and a very limited range of smart chargers as well. So basically, what I've done is get it tethered, and I've got a lead which I was given several years ago, which actually has the smart charging bits built into the lead, and I can use that to be on one of these tariffs. So it gives me the best of both worlds, really. It's got me delving into all the intricacies of type 2 cables and things, and things like you can't normally join two type 2 cables together, and you shouldn't really, because and the reason for that is if you've got two cables together and they should happen to come apart while it's charging, the end of the cable will be temporarily quite live and have quite a lot of voltage. Ooh. In it. So they're meant to be interlocked, and they're meant to be in, and the way they do that is by they have a what they call a presence pin. And on the cable that plugs plugs into the car, that's actually shorter than it is on the other end. So it doesn't make contact if you plug the two cables together. So it only makes contact if you plug it into the EV equipment. So actually, I've got that wrong way around. It's the cable which plugs into the socket is shorter. So the socket has a longer connector to the TV to get it. Whereas the connector, the socket on the plug which goes into the car, which is actually a socket, it's really confusing. So you actually have a female socket which plugs into a male plug in the car, although it looks like the other way around from all sorts of purposes. And And it's very simple. That cable, that pin just doesn't reach. So it doesn't think the cable's connected if you try and connect it to another cable. And that stops you connecting two chargers together. Really clever stuff.
Right.
And it's also also things like if you've got a cable that the wires in it are not capable of taking, say, 32 amps, you can actually tell the charger that it only takes 16 amps by putting a couple of resistors across two pins in the connector. And it tells the charger... Yeah. What type of thing? So lots of clever stuff in there in that cable standard, and it's it does work. It's quite a clever system to do it. But yeah, it's interesting changing over to being a tethered cable from an untethered one, and getting that all to work. And the one thing I still haven't quite got working yet is the interlock to make sure it actually locks the cable in, which is obviously quite essential as well. So but yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it takes a bit of planning, I suppose, to get all this sorted out.
It does, and I think nowadays I'd probably recommend people go untethered rather than tethered. It used to be you recommended people going tethered because it's faff to get your cables in and out, and it used to be that the chargers didn't lock the cables in, so if you had an untethered cable, you were always a little bit vulnerable because someone could come along and just steal your cable. But now, because they actually will, you can set them up to lock the cables in on most of the modern ones, it's not so much of an issue. Mm-hmm. So I think I'd probably recommend people who actually go untethered, that is, with a socket you plug the cable into, rather than actually having one with a cable attached to it, which is the tether type. It's definitely an interesting thing. Anyway, we got sidetracked there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, right. Well, we'll be back same time, same place next week. You can email Ian at thisislifestyle.com or leave comments or whatever. Please do the survey. I'm playing out with the demo track, with the D110. Check out our live stream from last week as well, and we'll see you next week.
Take care. Thank you.